Radio. This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Yasas, everybody, you know the drill. We started this podcast to help anybody who's interested in trapping and neutering animals. We are the help that we didn't receive when we first wanted to get involved, and we want to be your new friends in the TNR world. I'm Adele, one of your hosts for this episode, and I am so excited to have Anupriya here with me today.
Hi.
So Anupriya is an animal rights activist and vegan rescue founder. They are based in London and run a large-scale spay and neuter program for community animals from London in Delhi NCR, which over the last 8 years has successfully sterilized over 34,000, yes, that's correct, 34,000 dogs and cats. Along with this, they run another initiative that focuses on facilitating adoptions for rescued, abandoned, and abused companion animals. Anupriya has worked as a volunteer at multiple animal sanctuaries that focus on farmed animal species. I'm so happy you're here. Thank you for joining us. How are you today?
Good. Thank you for having me. And thank you for the introduction.
Yeah, of course. And we start every episode with a question. And that question is, how did you first get started in animal rights or animal rescue?
So I was born in India, in Bombay, and I grew up in Delhi. And I think it's really easy to get involved with animal rescue in a city where you just, there's so much right in front of you. I grew up with dogs and cats on the street where I lived. So I got involved very early on because I found a sick puppy right outside my house. I did what everyone does, took him to the shelter and saw that's probably not the best thing to do just because, you know, shelters are not spaces for puppies. There's rampant infections. So yeah, that's how I started. I just started by having the suffering right in front of me in Delhi.
And wanting to do something. How did you figure out that spay and neuter was the way that you wanted to help rather than what you tried to do the first time helping this puppy?
So I wanted to be a vet when I was in high school. And I started an apprenticeship at one of the most renowned vets in Delhi. And I had to do a summer project. So this was like 3 months of me going every single day and spending 10 hours at the vet clinic. Obviously, and this was a very posh area in Delhi. Most of the clients were people who had purchased these puppies and were, you know, breeders were coming in. And then there was like a small section of people that was bringing in rescued animals. So that already started me thinking, you know, about just why are we breeding animals while this is also happening? And that, you know, I'd also grown up seeing all these puppies in the streets. But on the other hand, my project was on Biometro and I did multiple case studies. I actually like assisted on surgeries. I looked at the uteruses. And I think once you've seen that and you know you can avoid it, yeah, spaying and neutering is the answer to the suffering on the streets, but also companion animals. So that's when I decided, really, there's no end to the suffering on the streets. And the only logical way to stop that cycle is to sterilize them. There's not enough resources. There's not enough. Yeah. So it just doesn't make sense to keep picking up animals off the streets, you know.
Yeah. And Biometro is one of those things that I think really clearly illustrates there's no other option because when for anybody who doesn't know, Biometro is an infection of the uterus. So this only happens to female animals who have a female reproductive system. It can happen when they're young. It can happen when they're old. It's more likely to happen when they're older. And when you have this infection, you have to remove the uterus. You have no other choice. They're going to become septic and they're going to die. And it's something that happens when they still have their uterus. And so it's a really simple answer. If you want to avoid a life-threatening issue like this for a female animal in the future, then you spay them. So, yeah. And also to your point, being surrounded by animals all the time and wanting to help but never having the resources, it's a really good reason to get into spay and neuter. And you obviously do an absolute huge amount of sterilizations. I know you do pickups every day, every week. Currently, you guys are in like the hundreds of sterilizations of dogs every week. Can you talk a little bit about how you got there, like what it looked like in the beginning and what has changed in order for you to be able to scale it up to where you are now?
Yeah, so when I decided that the way I wanted to contribute was to spay and neuter, I saw a random poster on a WhatsApp group about this woman who was doing spay and neuter, and she tied up with a local vet who had post-op facilities. And this vet was giving her decent rates. Not cheap enough to scale up to the level that we're doing now, but not bad, because considering he's a private vet. So I contacted her and to get my community dogs sterilized. And we just got talking. We realized we have common goals and I actually wanted to scale up. I was already running my adoption initiative at that point. So I had all these contacts of other rescuers who were in the same boat as me. They just didn't know where they can get these surgeries done. So I started to coordinate for them. We started scaling up. So it started with us doing about maybe 10 dogs a week, which was already quite a lot. It was quite a lot more than I knew anybody else was doing at that point because the government wasn't doing anything. So we started working with this vet. He has like enough space for maybe 10 dogs at a time, maximum. And that's how it started. So it looked quite small in terms of numbers. And then over time, we figured out how to really scale up and how to use existing facilities, existing veterinary facilities, existing transport facilities, existing skill sets that just sat there in Delhi unutilized because there was no funding. So that's how we scaled up. And I can talk more about that later.
Cool. Yeah. And I mean, as you said, resources are hugely related to the work that we're able to do. One of the things that I always talk about when we speak about rescue in India is this block on being able to fundraise, even for charities and organizations, and fundraise internationally, right? So things like GoFundMe that work everywhere else in the world, they don't work in India. You can't use them. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe some other laws in India that show kind of the situation that you're dealing with in rescue?
So, I mean, there are crowdfunding platforms that you can use in India. There's local ones called Milab. You can also make a GoFundMe. It's just that people do not care about and do not want to donate to spay and neuter programs in India. And usually what works is a really sad looking animal, you know, a really sick animal, a really sort of an accident case. People will donate to that. People just do not want to donate to spay neuter programs. And in terms of challenges, did you ask me about the laws?
Yeah, if there are any specific things around laws around rescue or nonprofits or anything like that.
Yeah, so there's laws around animal sterilization. So actually, if you read the Constitution of India, the government is supposed to allocate a budget to sterilize dogs. There's nothing about cats in the Constitution. Cats don't exist as an individual, as an entity. That's just not talked about at all in the Constitution. And that's all, it's because everything is human-centric. Dogs are considered a menace. Cats are considered invisible. Cats hide away. They live in trees. They live on roofs. Nobody really cares. For dogs, the reason there's so much legislature around dogs, there's so much, even now if you just go to Google and look up dog menace, Delhi High Court, Supreme Court, there's constant legal battles being fought. But actually, if you go and look at the Constitution, the government is supposed to do sterilizations at a very, very, there's a streamlined process, there's existing facilities, there's municipal corporation centers for every state that exist, but they are absolute horror shows. And a lot of the shelters we work with now actually are meant to be paid by the government, and they are meant to be doing sterilizations for the government. So they have a government tender, but because they are owed in the millions, the government's just not paying them. They've not been able to do any work, which is what I meant when I said, I don't want to reinvent the wheel. And we went back to these shelters and we said, you know what, you've got the vets, you've got the skills, you've got the vans, you've got trained employees, you've got the facilities, you've got space for post-op. We will pay you. We're going to pay you this much per dog we need 3 vans every day, you know, and we've got contacts with hundreds of volunteers now, which I'll again talk about later. But the laws exist. They're very loose. There is extreme corruption in India, which means the money never goes to the animals. There's things like, so organ counting is supposed, something these centers are supposed to do. We have uncovered cases of organs being transported from center to center. So basically the same organs being photographed and surgery is not actually being done. Or we picked up dogs who had clipped ears but were pregnant.
You mean like the reproductive organs?
Yeah, like testicles.
You mean like the reproductive organs, like the ovaries and the uterus? And
yeah. Yeah, so they're supposed to count the testicles, take pictures as proof that they've done these surgeries, but they're not doing them.
Wow, okay.
So, yeah, so they just take a bag, ship them center to center, take the photos of the same organs, don't actually do the surgeries, or they'll pick up dogs, clip their ears, and put them back. So we've had to pick up pregnant dogs with clipped ears. So the system is extremely fucked. Yeah, the laws around NGOs alone are fine. You can register an NGO and you can, you know, fundraise, but it's also the sentiment around spay neuter is very negative. There's a lot of religious sentiment against it as well. So fundraising for sterilization is very hard.
Yeah, that's a difficult point. And I think probably something that a lot of us experience. I've mentioned it before at conferences that we don't rely on the municipal systems for sterilization and for sheltering. And I've had people in America and other places in the global north ask why. Because their shelters, while yes, they are overcrowded and there's huge amounts of euthanasia of healthy animals, they're probably not the same. They're not functioning the same as the ones that we are used to. And the tricky thing is, especially with spay and neuter, is, I mean, any kind of healthcare, we need some kind of social support system for the large amount of animals and people who need help, right? But the reason why most of the rescue work, the sterilization work, is done by private organizations is because for some reason we can't access those municipal or government services, even if there are funds allocated, as you said, or they are of a quality that we are not comfortable with. But what I think was really interesting that you said is they still have some capacity, right? And so even though we have these struggles, you still tried to reach out and collaborate in some way, whether that's with the van or whether that's with spaces.
No, let me just correct myself. So we don't work with the municipal centers. We work with private shelters that have been given government tenders. So they have part of their shelter that meant to have been paid by the government, but isn't. We do not work with any of the municipalities. Because I just don't trust them. One of the major fears outside of quality of work is relocation. It's a huge problem.
Like dumping animals in another place.
Exactly. So they will pick up an animal from one place, usually from affluent places because they've been bribed by people who think of them as a menace and dumped elsewhere in less affluent spaces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is really difficult because in an ideal world of animal care and animal rescue, we are able to work with local government and there should be like allocation of resources for animals in communities so that they're treated like community animals. But because like in Greece, it's the same because of this, a lot of people feel there's a lack of support or maybe a lack of transparency, like you mentioned, not being able to trust. There is a lot of frustration around them not fulfilling their obligations for by the law or not having the same like motivation or intent of doing that same quality work as everybody wants to do for the animals. And so it's difficult because we know that that has to be part of the future of animal care, rescue, sterilization, sheltering, etc. But we can't bridge that gap on our own. And so it just results in a lot of frustration and resentment. And then a lot of individual rescuers and organizations won't work with municipalities. And there's just not that connection. There's not that conversation.
No.
But other people are really important to what you do, right? So you mentioned these vans where you pick up dogs and transport them to vet clinics. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like, what the people in your group do? Because you do all this work from London and you have teams of people who support this work that you are trying to conduct in Delhi.
Yes. So there's many aspects to this. So I do a lot of the coordination. It's just me and Akrita. So Akrita manages all of this. I don't even know how she does it, but she manages all of the coordination between the vets and the NGOs that we partner with. And also all of, so I'm younger. I'm more sort of on social media. I have all these contacts with, I think we have about 300 ground volunteers in different parts of Delhi and NCR, which is the National Capital Region. We also go out to slightly nearby other cities that have even worse municipalities. So they really, if we don't go there, there's literally nobody doing spay and neuter there. So I have all these contacts, but I don't actually do the coordination. That all of that coordination is done by Akrita for dogs. I do the cats. But I'm talking about dogs more just because that's where we're doing a lot more in terms of just pure numbers. I will talk about the challenges with cats as well. And then, so I think the main three aspects are the NGOs, and the NGOs have the vets, the post-op facilities, and the vans. So these are shelters that I mentioned that are private shelters that have all of this infrastructure that's just not being used, which we're trying to use by making sure they're paid for every single service that they offer us. We also work with private vets on a smaller scale, usually for cases where shelters just won't take the animals, such as younger animals, weaker animals, pregnant animals, things like that. So there's all of these challenges. So we have vets and we have shelters that we work with. Then there's myself and Akrita. And then the third most important aspect is all of the ground volunteers. So they're the ones who are tracking these dogs. They're the ones who are feeding them. They know their health history. They're helping us vaccinate them prior to pickups when possible. They're, you know, letting us know if there's any issues post-operatively. They're amazing. So, you know, they know each and every dog. Their dogs have names. They're cared for every single day. They're fed. They're given beds to sleep in the winter. Delhi has every kind of weather. So you need to make sure they're protected from the rain, from the winter, from the summer. So, you know, all of these are caregivers. So these caregivers usually contact us, and this is a range of people. They could be very young students who just have dogs in their college campus that they want to help. We have people who are domestic workers, who are drivers, cab drivers, who really have no means but just care for the animals that live around them. They want to help them. Seldom do we have people that actually do have the means and the time and still want to help, because, you know, it's easy to ignore the suffering when you're living in luxury. So I guess that's there. And then, of course, donors are important, but they're not teams.
Yeah, I think that this point of the role of caregivers is really important, especially in your city and the other cities that you work in. And it's one of the reasons why now, whenever we talk about cats and sterilization and stuff like that, we talk about them in terms of community animals. I think it's very normal to talk about like stray cats, stray dogs, homeless, or, you know, street cats, street dogs, whatever. But we had a conversation about this a few years ago, and you explained why you and your team view the cats and dogs that live in these communities as part of the community, and they are given care by caregivers, as you've just explained, people who struggle to make ends meet already. And it's a much more like holistic, community-based approach to them being in part of the community. I just thought that was really nice. Like, that's true. They exist there. They live there. That is their home as well. And they live alongside people. And perhaps if we viewed them as community members, maybe our approach to them would be a bit different. What does that relationship look like in the areas that you work in?
So that sounds amazing, the way you put it. But unfortunately, it's not like that all the time. We work in very impoverished areas. We work in areas that have no humans at all, but there's dogs massively constantly reproducing. In India, so street dogs are very resilient, and there's a lot of trash dumping that happens. So they get by, and they survive and they have litter after litter. So a lot of the areas we work with, we work in, are just, they're like hundreds of dogs, empty lands, villages where there is so much suffering that honestly, even if the people and the locals wanted to help, they just don't have the means. So one of the major projects that we took on in 2017 was Kora Village. It's been 8 years. We've sterilized thousands of dogs and we continue to sterilize more and more dogs. And I don't even know how so many dogs are living in that village, because honestly, there are no means. So it's a huge village. It's not a small village, but there is a lot of community feeling in some spaces, and where people can, they do offer them support. But really, when we start targeting an area, we want to get as many, at least 80 to 90% of the population. And most of these spaces are vast lands, which is dogs breeding. Pitampura is an area where we've been working on. The volunteers now just go there to find more dogs and get them sterilized. So these are not necessarily dogs that are being looked after, but we do have volunteers who are motivated enough to go and count them and really help us do as many as possible. Yeah, because they survive. It's not like they will just die off. They will survive, but yeah, with extreme levels of suffering. And that's an added challenge, because often they're very emaciated and the vets will be like, we can't operate on these dogs. But then what do? We release them just to have more puppies, you know?
Yeah, it sounds like people actually going out and identifying the dogs, counting them, is a part of the targeting, right? If we're going to get to 80 or 90% sterilization, which is kind of the generally agreed upon percentage of at least the population, the reproduction rate not exploding as it has been, and it getting to a more manageable level, and then we can focus on the last remaining animals. So how does that look? The people that are actually going out, identifying the dogs, counting them, maybe vaccinating or parasite treating them, and then the actual pickups. Like, how do you identify dogs for pickups, and what does it look like when they go out to pick them up?
So I'm just going to use Kora Village as an example, just because it's easy for me to visualize. Counting is endless. We usually end up, so we have three volunteers who are helping us with the village. One of them's called Neelam. She is incredible. She does not live in Kora Village, but she will travel there every single day if she needs to. And she really has developed a community. So she knows the locals that live there, especially the kids. The kids are amazing. They're so helpful. They know where each dog will be found sleeping if we go at a certain time of the day. And this is something I've witnessed as well. I used to go into Majnuka Tila and do a similar thing where I used to count the dogs. And usually it's like, it's a show, right? A van comes. There's a lot of noise. The dogs make noise. The locals make noise. And the kids have nothing to do. So they follow the van around, you know, watching what's going on. So they're very interested. And there's a mix. There's people who are really anti us picking up the dogs. They'll actually take the dogs into their homes and say, no, you're not taking this dog anywhere. We're not letting you take that dog. Slowly over time, we build a relationship. We make them understand that, you know, we're doing this for their benefit. Look at what happened last time this dog had puppies. Did any of them survive? So there's a lot of relationship and people management, but usually the counting doesn't happen alone. Usually they have to rely on the people who are actually living there, because these spaces are very cluttered. Dogs hide, especially during like busy hours of the day. You don't really get to see all of them. So you do want to establish more and more support within the local communities. So that's how the counting looks. They tend to, and that also helps us track the dog's health. You know, if someone's been ill, they let us know and we can help when possible. It also means that it's easier to catch them, because these dogs tend to sometimes trust people who live around them if they've shown any kindness to them. So that's how it looks. We usually have, Neelam will have a list of 20 dogs she wants to send on a particular day. The van will come at 8 a.m. There are 3 catchers, and so these are humans with a net in their hands. There is a driver who is usually also trained to catch, because there's a lot of running around happening at this point, because Neelam's kind of spotting the dogs and the catchers are running around and trying to make sure they're on both sides. In cluttered, closed villages, it's easier because the lanes are super narrow. So you can usually just have the net on one side. The dog's going to run from the other side. They usually run right into the net. And it's quick. We don't want to elongate the suffering and the trauma. So we just want to be as quick as possible with this. In large open spaces, it's very hard. So other means might have to be, you know, some people look into safe sedation as an option, something we don't regularly do at all. But in village spaces, it's actually quite easy. So the van will come, they'll target picking up between 10 to 12 dogs. If it's a hot day, we don't want to fill up the van because it's hot inside. Because you're going to spend more time catching them. So they're going to be sat in the van for longer. And two, you don't want them sort of piling onto each other. You want enough space for each dog, a bowl of water in the van. And yeah, so the aim is to get 10 to 12 dogs. They go to the clinic. They're operated on the next day and they stay. Again, it depends on the vet. But if done with our private vets, it's usually 48 hours to 72 hours. If it's done in the shelter, it's usually 4 to 5 days of post-operative care. And once they're fine, they're vaccinated for rabies, and then they're released back exactly where they were picked up from.
Cool. That's a really long recovery period. That's awesome to hear that you're able to do that and make sure they're in good shape before they go back out. I think the catchers, if I understand correctly, they go through specialized training as well, right? Yes. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like?
Yes. So there are, it depends on which shelter and which catchers I'm talking about. There are shelters that are now trained within Delhi to provide this training to anybody that they employ. But there are also small programs that happen in different cities in India, which is specific to safe animal catching, safe dog catching. So you can actually, I think it's like a 2-week long program where they teach you different techniques. One is how to use the net properly, because obviously the net has metal around it. You want to make sure that the dog's not getting, you know, hit by the metal. You have to make sure that you're angling it correctly. So there are specialized trainings that happen for that. There's also a sack method that's used where, you know, you take a sack and you literally put it on top of a sleeping dog. That's also something they receive training for. Scruffing is something that's really, really not done on dogs. But again, in case it comes to that, they are trained on how to safely scruff without hurting themselves or the dogs, because a lot of these dogs are very skittish and they will bite if they feel threatened. Yeah, so there's a certificate and they have to go through this training before they're allowed on the field.
That's really cool. And I think it highlights that catching and trapping is actually skilled labor. And some of the things you mentioned are how we are making the animals feel that we're trapping, because it is very scary. Like, they don't particularly know who these people are. They're just going into a van. They're going to a clinic. Like, it's totally foreign to them. They don't understand. This obviously brings a lot of fear, anxiety, and stress. And none of these things are good for an animal who's going through surgery and potentially has pre-existing health conditions. To recover from surgery properly, their immune system has to have a good response to the surgery. They need to recover quickly. And if they had any pre-existing conditions, not succumb to that because their immune system is protecting them. But when their cortisol levels are high, this interferes with that, doesn't it? And that's one of the reasons why, just logistically, even if we're not thinking about their welfare, which we should be, but just logistically, it makes more sense to reduce fear, anxiety, and stress, and therefore their cortisol levels being lower and them recovering better. And you have better output, safer trapping, and better output recovery.
Absolutely. That's why another reason to involve the locals is a lot of the times they'll just pick up the dogs in their arms and put them in the van for you. And that's the best way possible. And the reason for these kind of trappings, we only do surgery the next day, is because of their cortisol levels as well. Because, you know, they've calmed down and we don't want to put them through surgery after having been trapped with a net.
That's really interesting to think about, because I think a lot of us perhaps are thinking, okay, like, let's trap them, let's get them into the vet and sterilize and woken up as quickly as possible. But perhaps taking some time for their stress levels to drop before surgery could have better output. That's cool. And then you have a really interesting story of trapping fearful dogs, which can be really complicated, but is important for making sure that we are sterilizing as close to 100% of the animals as possible, right? Because it just takes one birth of, I don't know, 9 yeah. puppies, half of them being female, to restart all of that cycle. So yeah, I'd love to hear any like specific story or example about a really difficult trapping, or how you approach trapping skittish animals or particularly interesting cases.
Yeah, so I live outside of my family home is right in front of the North Delhi Ridge Forest, which is a huge several kilometer long forest that spans Delhi all the way into central Delhi, all the way into South Delhi, and Delhi is huge. And we look after as many dogs as that we know of, at least the ones that live outside of in that region of the forest in front of our house. So these dogs are, as I wouldn't call them feral, but I guess some of them are. Not all of them. A lot of them are quite friendly. But these dogs are impossible to catch. They know body language really well. They know how to preserve themselves, and they know when there's danger. So we've tried everything. I grew up there. I've been doing sterilizations myself since 2010. And I've tried everything. I've tried with local NGOs. I've tried with different catchers. I've tried with private catchers. We've done everything, you know. And nothing seems to be working for some of these dogs. And like you said, when I said 80 to 90%, I would say 100% of the adults need to be sterilized. And all sterilizable dogs need to be sterilized. This excludes puppies that are too young or etc. So we actually have attempted different things. And one thing that we attempted last year, for this pack of 7 dogs that was constantly breeding and they were not getting picked up. We tried with the best catchers in Delhi and we couldn't even catch one of them, except one puppy who we got and got spayed quite early and she's fine. So we built a cage. We took special permission. So this is a reserve forest, and it comes under the forest department and the horticulture department, and every other department in Delhi is involved because there's historical value and agricultural value and etc. So there's a lot of red tape around this forest, which makes things quite complicated. And we had to take special permission, make a case, really beg them to let us continue our work that they keep impeding, even though the government is meant to actually aid sterilization effort. We took special permission, got a cage built, and my father fed the dogs inside this cage every day for a month, because these dogs, you have to make sure that, so they do know that food is coming in the morning, but they don't come to you for the food. They wait for you to put the food, move several meters away.
Yeah.
Don't make eye contact with them, and only then will they start eating. So my dad had to feed them inside this closed box every day for a month and slowly reduce the distance he was standing at. And finally, one day, and I told him, and we couldn't even call like a van and have them stood outside, because these dogs know the smells. They know they know something fishy is going on. So my dad one day managed to shut the door, because obviously there's a door to the cage. Then he called me up and he's like, okay, I've managed to trap all 7 of them. They're all inside. And then I called the transport van. I was like, okay, they're all in. You just need to go there and put them in the van. Obviously, driving into a forest is not easy. So this was also another big challenge, getting the van inside the forest. But we managed. And the whole pack, this side of the forest is now sterilized. We obviously have more dogs relocating in. That always happens whenever the population gets sterilized. More come in from other places. But yeah, it was quite an expensive cage to build, and most people said this is not going to work. They're never going to go inside, but it didn't hurt to try, and it worked. So that was great.
That's fantastic. And the fact that you got all 7 of them at once is probably really important, because otherwise they would understand what was happening, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Trapping the difficult ones is a huge challenge, but that's really cool. I mean, you went to every effort to make sure that you could do it, and now they're all neutered. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that is all really interesting. Thank you for sharing everything about like the situation of rescue and sterilization and trapping and, you know, the local community and all of these kinds of things. If there is any
last words you want to share or any like main takeaway you'd like to share with anybody, please do. And if you could also mention like your social media pages and where you'd like people to find your Dogs of Delhi work.
I guess my last words are that I know it can feel very isolating to figure out how to spay and neuter a community animal or any animals. But if there is something you want to do for the animals in your community, even if they're not living on the streets, maybe they're in somebody's house, I think the best thing you can do for them is to spay and neuter. You can always reach out to us. So our Instagram handle is dodspayneuter. And I'm always happy to, you know, connect people with resources in other countries and other cities if possible. So we're always trying to build out community, understand the gaps, and help out other people who want to do the same thing, because really there's no other solution.
Awesome.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And thank you for sharing all of that. We're really excited to have you here and about this podcast in general. It's really awesome and inspiring hearing from people like you and stories like this. And we would really love to hear about everybody else's experience. So feel free to send us a DM on either Saving Lives with two A's or Travel Animal Rescue on Instagram. And then see you all at our next episode. And in the meantime, stay out of trouble and keep trapping to save the streets one animal at a time.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.